This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, it's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Rob Siegel, the director of the film Big Fan, in which Patton Oswalt, playing a New York Giants football fan and regular caller to sports radio, is beaten up by his favorite player on the team. Here's a clip from the film.
Hematoma, the bleeding from the vein between the brain and the skull. Fortunately, we were able to successfully drain it.
So I'm going to be okay?
You sustained some pretty heavy trauma, but long run you should be. We do need to keep you another few days for observation.
Another few days? How long have I been here?
3 days.
3 days? So the day is Sunday?
Monday.
Monday. How did we do? What was the score?
41-28.
We gave up 41 to the Chiefs. Did Quantrell suspended?
Yeah.
For how long?
Game by game basis. They say it depends on the investigation.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the program, Rob Siegel, was once upon a time the editor of the satirical newspaper The Onion, but he left that gig to become a screenwriter. After a few years of writing comedies that didn't get that far, he hit a home run with the script for the Mickey Rourke vehicle, The Wrestler, which was obviously hugely critically acclaimed last year. Now he's just about to release his first writer-directorial debut. His first writer-directorial debut?
Writorial.
Thank you.
Directorial debut.
Right. You're a professional writer, so you know these kinds of things. A dark comedy, a very dark comedy called Big Fan. Rob, welcome to The Sound of Young America. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Jesse. It's good to be here. Let me correct you right off the bat. I don't know if it's a comedy. That might set up expectations wrong. I'm a little concerned. It's more of a drama with darkly funny things in it.
There was a wide variety of reactions to the film in the screening room that I was sitting in. A man who was laughing way too much, and that kind of upset me.
Uh-huh.
Some people who didn't laugh at all, and that also kind of upset me. It was a real mixed bag.
But you laughed the perfect amount?
Oh, absolutely. Of course. What other amount would I laugh, Rob?
You're smart.
You were the editor of The Onion at a time when The Onion was, I mean, it remains one of the greatest.
During its glory years.
It remains one of the greatest things in the world, but it was certainly, you know, it was during its meteoric ascent.
Heyday? Peak? What's the word you're looking for?
I feel like it plateaued at some point,
no,
but I've never felt like it's gone downhill.
It's still great. I think it's been consistently great.
But
for...
you were editor during a very exciting time when it was really becoming a force to be reckoned with in the world.
Yeah.
Why did you want to leave?
You know, I was there for 9 years, from 94 to 2003. And when you write for The Onion, it's really a full-time job. Your brain is always in onion mode. So you process the world and everything in it in headline form. and it can just kind of drive you mad after a while. And some people are able to do it. There are people there who were there before I got there, you know, who've been doing it for 15, 20 years now. For me, 9 years was kind of the limit of how long I could push my brain to, you know, in area man. Mode, and I just needed to use a different part of my creative mind to avoid going crazy.
How many headlines did you write in a given week?
You generally try to bring maybe 25, 30 to a meeting. There's a weekly meeting where everybody pitches stories. I don't know what the number is now, but we generally tried to bring about 25 to 30 headlines
That's just a monumental number of jokes when you're dealing with a significantly sized staff.
It's a lot of jokes. We kind of operated, and I imagine still do operate on a quantity makes quality system. You know, you throw enough things at the wall, something is going to stick. I think the more ideas you pitch, the more likely it is, just mathematically, statistically, the more likely it is you're going to get something funny. And we tried really hard not to be precious about it. And, you know, you don't want to walk into a meeting with five jewels that you're really attached to and then you find nobody likes them. You want to be totally dispassionate about it. And the more ideas you have, the easier it is to do that.
Well, what kind of films were you writing when you left The Onion?
I left in 2003, and on my tax return under profession, for about 6 years I was writing comedy writer. So I kind of got in the habit of looking at myself as a comedy writer. So when I left The Onion, I tried to write comedies, kind of in the Judd Apatow mold, you know, not lowbrow, but you know, just good solid quality Apatow style comedies, and I was pretty bad at it. I just, for some reason, it just never clicked, and I wrote script after script, and I found I was sort of writing with the audience in mind. I was writing things that I thought would sell rather than things that turned me on. I don't know, they were all kind of uniformly mediocre. I got better at the craft of screenwriting, but the actual scripts didn't really get much more original. And then my breakthrough script was Big Fan, which at the time was called Paulo Fierro. And that was the script that kind of within Hollywood I started getting known for, and it circulated around. And that script was not a comedy, at least, well, I guess it's debatable still. But you know, it's more of, compared to the things I was writing, which were more things that maybe Adam McKay would direct, it was more of some kind of a dark 70s Scorsese, you know, kind of character drama.
Did you feel ambivalent about the stuff you were writing when you were writing in the sort of commercial comedy genre?
Yeah, I was definitely ambivalent, and I was writing. I think there was a certain cynicism that I was writing what I thought. I was writing kind of down to my imagined audience. I probably, on some subconscious level, had this attitude like, you know, this is the kind of junk that Hollywood eats up and loves, and I'm just going to give them what they want, and it kind of caught me by surprise that what I wrote was actually not that good, and I think it was because I wrote it from I think any screenwriter, even if you're writing crap, I think the crappy movies are even the worst movies and the lowest of lowbrow comedies are written from kind of a sincere place. What I see is kind of, you know, being a comedy snob myself, what I see is kind of lame movies that the people who write them really think they're funny.
Did you feel like a comedy snob at the time? Was there a time when you considered, oh gosh, I should try and write the next, Superbad, rather than I should write the next, one of those movies that Adam Sandler puts all his friends in?
Like White Chicks or...
Yeah, well, what was that one that had John Lovitz and David Spade, and they were on a softball team together? That's what I'm thinking of.
Joe Dirt?
No, I think it was they were on a softball team. This is a real movie. I'm not making this up. And I think maybe John Hader from Napoleon Dynamite was also on the softball team.
Oh, the Benchwarmers.
There you go.
Everyone in the audience is probably screaming that out in their cars.
No, they're not. This is public radio.
everyone. The Benchwarmers,
they're
of course.
Screaming
I'm
out,
sorry.
Truffaut,
Rob Schneider,
Truffaut.
David Spade, and John Hader probably about 5 years ago. Yeah. Well, I knew I didn't want to write... Being a comedy snob, I knew I didn't want to write, like, Benchwarmers, real stupid comedies. And you know, in my mind, there were those dumb comedies, and then there were quality comedies, which I enjoy watching, you know, more things like, you know, Anchorman or Zoolander or Knocked Up or 40-Year-Old Virgin, you know, things that I like and respect but are still clearly comedies. So I aimed to write those types of movies, and it just wasn't, I don't know, it just never clicked. So then I guess I went from, I knew I didn't want to write White Chicks. I tried to write Knocked Up, And then I realized what I was better at writing was, you know, King of Comedy, or I went from being a Judd Apatow wannabe, and now I'm probably a Paul Thomas Anderson wannabe.
What was the – how did you realize that?
Well, I realized it by not going anywhere with these scripts. And then one day I had this idea for a script about a sports fan. I had this idea for a sports fan who gets beaten up by his favorite player. And the way I imagined it was not a comedy. And at first my instinct said, don't write this because it's not a comedy. But then I said, wait a minute, maybe let's just try it. And then I wrote it. I wrote it during while I was still at the Onion, during one of our holiday breaks. We have like 2 weeks off during December every year. And instead of going away, I just locked myself in my room, and for the 2 weeks I just wrote, and when the 2 weeks were over, I had the script, or the first draft of a script, and I looked at it and I said, this is actually pretty good, and it's not a comedy, and you know, this kind of light bulb went off, I guess.
When you've been making your living, at least as a screenwriter, by doing things like, you know, adding jokes to Night at the Museum 2 or whatever it is, what was the reaction you got from your agent and your contacts and the people that you worked with when you came to them and said, I wrote this script, it's kind of like Taxi Driver?
They liked it. I don't know. There wasn't any real resistance because it was, I mean, at the risk of sounding immodest, it was clearly a better script than anything else I'd ever written. So they had the wisdom to, you know, embrace it.
What happened to the script after you wrote it?
I wrote it in 2000, probably 2001. I kind of released it into the Hollywood ether, and it circulated around. You know, I submitted it to my agent, and then inevitably it kind of gets around town, and it made the blacklist. I think in 2002, which is the secret list of top unproduced screenplays, and it started to develop a reputation, and it started to find its way to different directors. And the first director who contacted me about it, who was interested in possibly making it, was Darren Aronofsky, and that's actually how I met Darren. And we got together for coffee, and we talked about it, and he really liked it. And for about a year, it was in his possession, as you know, on his plate of things to develop, with an eye toward directing. And we had a few meetings and talked about different directions to take the story. And eventually, he wound up not directing it. I think it was in pre-production on The Fountain at the time, so he let it go. And then a few months later, I don't remember the exact chronology, but probably a few months later, he called me up and said he's got another idea for another movie that he'd like to talk to me about that he thinks I might be a good fit for, which was The Wrestler. And he said to me, you know, how would you like to write a movie set in the world of professional wrestling or about a former pro wrestler? And I immediately responded to that idea.
Let's hear a clip from The Wrestler.
You have a beer with me?
I gotta get going.
One beer.
I got a kid.
You have a kid? Well, would he have a boy or a girl?
Boy. Jameson.
How old?
9.
Hold on. Wait a second. I want you to give this to your little guy. It's a Randy the Ram action figure. Tell him not to lose it. It's a $300 collector's item.
Really?
No. Come on, hey. One beer.
Okay.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Rob Siegel, director of the movie Big Fan, in which an enthusiastic football fan is beaten to a pulp by his favorite player. The former Onion editor also wrote last year's The Wrestler after he was approached to do so by director Darren Aronofsky. What did he bring you, and what did you generate for the wrestler?
He said he had this idea kicking around. He apparently, when he was back in film school in the 90s sometime, he had a little notebook and he kept lists of ideas for things he'd like to make a movie about. And one of the things he always had on his list was a movie about a pro wrestler. he felt that there had been all these serious... Boxing was always treated seriously in movies, and there were all these, you know, great classic boxing movies that were intense, dark character studies about boxers, and there had never been a serious movie done about a wrestler. It was always kind of treated as a joke. And he thought that this would be a really interesting world for you know, penetrating character study about an old-time wrestler. And then we went to a few shows together. We knew it wasn't going to be about a WWF wrestler for reasons legal and creative. We wanted it to be about a kind of a more washed-up guy. And there's this whole indie circuit out there that most people don't even know exists. You know, any Friday night you go to Passaic, New Jersey, or just kind of outer, you know, someplace in Queens, at VFW halls and church basements, there are these wrestling shows, and usually it's kind of weekend warrior type wannabe guys who are sort of fulfilling a fantasy. But then they usually have one former, often they'll try to get like a former pro wrestler, a name guy to be the headliner. And a lot of the old 80s wrestlers, as a kid, I was a wrestling fan, not crazy hardcore or anything, but you know, growing up I was a teenager in the 80s, and it was hard not to, you know, at least be exposed.
It's hard not to be a Hulkamaniac.
Yeah, I was probably 15 at the peak of Hulkamania, and you know, I went to a few shows at Nassau Coliseum. I grew up on Long Island, and I went to a few shows, and I saw. So I have fond memories of, and I remember vividly, you know, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat and Coco Beware and Big Boss Man, and you know, it goes on and on. So the idea of doing a movie set about one of those guys really appealed to me. And we'd go, so I went to a few of these shows, and you'd see Bam Bam Bigelow and Nikolai Volkoff and Tito Santana and all these old wrestlers who I remember as a kid were, you know, playing the Garden, and now they're playing, you know, some Latin disco in, Passaic, New Jersey, or you know, some high school gym out in Suffolk, Long Island or something. And they all were really, they're all kind of sad, and you know, their knees were battered, and they needed hip replacement surgery, and they didn't have health insurance, but they still really so it was sad, but it was also sort of awesome, because they still all clearly got a thrill out of wrestling, even though it was only for maybe 100 people instead of 20,000. So it was just a great. I immediately, as soon as I started going to these shows, I knew that I wanted to write a movie about it. But there was nothing more specific than that.
It's interesting to me that you mentioned that Aronofsky had said, you know, there's all these great movies about boxing and none about wrestling. Boxing is a sport where, you know, very conveniently for drama's sake, there is this really elemental battle at the end, mm-hmm. Where, you know, two people literally have a conflict, and you know, there's literally someone comes out of it the winner. Wrestling is a lot more complicated, being as that it's essentially a performance.
Right.
How did that fact that wrestling is a performance make you think differently about the structure of the film and what was important about the film?
Well, because wrestling is quote unquote fake, you can't really write it the way you would. You can't just replace boxing with wrestling and have it work. Because like you said, boxing, there is actually inherent drama there's inherent drama in who will win a boxing match, you know? So the drama had to come from someplace other than the actual outcome of the match, you know, Rocky, the ending of Rocky is incredibly suspenseful because it ends with a boxing match where him and Apollo Creed are, you know, bashing each other's brains in, and the actual outcome of that match is suspenseful, you know. When Randy the Ram Robinson who Mickey Rourke plays is wrestling the Ayatollah, it's not that same kind of traditional sports movie climax, because it's sort of predetermined who's going to win, and it doesn't even really matter who's going to win. You know, in wrestling, you know, doesn't really have any actual impact. So the drama had to come from just this guy's life, and it just couldn't. Which is a good thing for it, because we were forced to. We couldn't just fall back on sort of sports movie cliches of he either winds up, you know, triumphantly victorious, carried off the field, you know, on his teammate's shoulders, so to speak, or he's, you know, defeated, but, you know, wins some kind of moral victory. It's less a story about an athlete. Well, it is a story about an athlete, but it's really a story about a performer more. You know, it kind of has the structure of a movie, maybe about a dancer, say, if that makes sense.
Here's another clip from The Wrestler.
I just want to tell you, I'm the one who is supposed to take care of everything. I'm the one who is supposed to make everything okay for everybody. It just didn't work out like that. And I left. I left you. You never did anything wrong. You know? I used to try to forget about you. I used to try to pretend that you didn't exist. But I can't. You're my girl. You're my little girl. And now I'm an old broken down piece of meat and I'm alone.
When we come back, we hear about Siegel's directorial debut with Big Fan. Stick around. It's The Sound of Young America from PRI, Public Radio International.
Production of The Sound of Young America is underwritten in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
This September, MaximumFun.org is headed east. You can check out The Sound of Young America Live, our live stage show, in Philadelphia, September 16th, as part of the Philly Fringe. It's a live Sound of Young America program played out before your very eyes with music, comedy, and interviews. Our guests on the Philadelphia show include the Spinto Band, comics artist Charles Burns, the director of the Mutter Museum, and more. Then, the next night, we'll be offering the freewheeling comedy of the Monsters of Podcasting. That's You Look Nice Today and our own Jordan Jesse Go. On the 18th, we'll be headed to New York for a live show at the Jerome L. Green Performance Space at WNYC. My guests include Scott Adsit from the NBC comedy 30 Rock, musicians Nellie Mackay and Andrew W.K., and much more. Saturday, September 19th, the Monsters of Podcasting hit the UCB Theater in New York. For more information and tickets, visit MaximumFun.org.
Hey, what's happening? Mike Schmidt, host of the 40-Year-Old Boy Podcast, available on iTunes and at MikeSchmidtComedy.com. What's the show about, you ask? I can hear you asking it. That's right. You know what the show's about? Me hearing people talking in their houses as they play me. That's right. Well, if you're playing my podcast or you hear my voice, please know that I can hear you at all times. I'm tapped in like that. I'm kind of like the dog whisperer, but via podcasts. I don't know if that makes any sense at all. So go to MikeSchmidtComedy.com, go to iTunes, and subscribe to the 40-Year-Old Boy Podcast. It's no Sound of Young America Radio show, but we do use microphones.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Rob Siegel, the director of the film Big Fan, in which Patton Oswalt, playing a New York Giants football fan and regular caller to sports radio, is beaten up by his favorite player on the team. In Big Fan, Patton Oswalt, a frequent past guest on this show, plays a huge New York Giants fan who's very deeply immersed in the culture of sports talk radio.
Right.
I don't know if folks out there, you know, they probably are too busy listening to the Sound of Young America on their local public radio station to switch over to their local sports talk station. But in sports talk radio, there are, even more so, I think, than in any other form of radio, there's a sort of ecosystem of callers and personalities that revolve around the shows.
Yeah, it's a little, there's a little mini community of callers. You know, there's Joe from Flushing and Vinny from Rego Park. And if you listen for any stretch of time, you'll start to hear a lot of the same guys and they become familiar and they sort of become friends.
I still remember as a kid, I used to listen a lot to KNBR in San Francisco. And there was a regular caller named Johnny the Gout Man.
Johnny the Gout Man. Yeah, every station in every city has, you know, there was Doris from There was, last year, you know how the New York Times does an annual The Lives They Lived kind of obituary issue? Last year there was a woman named Doris. She's sort of a classic caller. Doris from Rego Park, I think, who was a big regular on WFAN, which is the station I grew up listening to. But yeah, they're all over the place.
Did you listen to a lot of sports talk radio at some point in your life?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I listened every night. That was the kind of the origin for this movie. I listened to WFAN, which at the time was the only. It was the first sports radio station in the country. And in early to mid '80s, when I was a little kid, I would listen every night. I would go to bed, turn out the lights, and then turn on the radio and just kind of lie there in the dark and listen way past my bedtime. I would listen to the Steve Summers show, which was Schmoozing with Steve Summers, if anyone knows him. And I just I don't know, there was something magical about it. I just loved eavesdropping on these people's lives, and you kind of couldn't help but listening to them. You kind of couldn't help but wonder, you know, what their lives were like and what their rooms looked like and what they were like off the air. And that was the genesis of the movie.
Did you ever call in yourself?
No, I was never one of those. You heard it all the time, you know, long time listener, first time caller is the phrase. I always just listened. I never even was tempted to call. I would have been scared.
I called in once. I remember this is a long time ago. I'm realizing because I remember the subject of the call was whether the San Francisco Giants should sign the one-handed
Jim Abbott.
Yeah, Jim Abbott, yeah, the one-handed California, now Anaheim Angels star. Jim Abbott, and I think I was against it.
You were opposed.
And I wasn't prepared for how terrifying it was.
It's, yeah, I just didn't want to break that wall. I just wanted this just to keep, you know, stay anonymous.
I went to see Big Fan with my wife, and we had very different reactions to it. I think essentially because we had very different reactions to the central premise, which is a man who has built his life around sports. And she said to me, you know, I can't imagine caring about anything that much besides maybe my family. And I wonder if you have ever, whereas I, being a nerd, have cared about many things, at least.
Are you, what kind of nerd are you?
I'm not a comic book nerd. I'm a lapsed baseball nerd.
Okay.
I'm a comedy nerd. And those are my two main nerddoms.
Yeah, I would say mine are comedy, probably comedy and sports.
Right. So could you relate to caring that much about something that...
Yeah, well, not to that extreme degree, but absolutely. I mean, I think most people... I feel sad for your wife. I think most people can, if they can't relate to it in terms of sports fandom, they can, you know, there certainly are many, many people out there who are way, way too into, you know, whether it's, you know, I mean, God, anything, some cooking or Michael Jackson, or whatever it is, there are no shortage of things to be obsessive about. And most people are, I think most people are obsessive about something, particularly in the internet. You know, the internet has certainly fed that. I mean, it's just a giant repository of obsessions. So I think hopefully enough people will relate to it to make it a success.
I don't want to get spoiler-y in my line of questioning, but I think it's safe to say that this isn't a film that's about a traditional redemption.
No,
it's not about someone going through a crucible and emerging as a new person.
No, I hate those.
Yeah, why do you hate those, and why isn't it that? Why, in fact, is it? It strikes me almost the opposite. It's almost about someone going through a crucible and realizing that they are the person they want to be.
Yeah. Which I would say the same thing is true probably for the wrestler. I think I may have written the same movie twice. they're both about guys on the fringes of sports who are way, way into something that other people don't particularly respect, and the world wants them to change, and all they want to do is kind of keep doing what they love. And they're both fundamentally happy That might sound like a weird word to use for these guys, but they both really get the satisfaction, you know, that they want out of life from wrestling and rooting for the Giants.
Is that the case? I'm almost surprised to hear you say that about Patton's character in this movie. I mean, you open the movie with a very sort of long, slow, sad shot of the parking garage where he works as an attendant, and there's a little scenelet where somebody drives by and
somebody's a dick to him.
Yeah,
that's my brother-in-law.
in the world of the film, or acting as a jerk?
No, my actual brother-in-law.
I'm surprised to hear you say that you think he's fundamentally happy.
Maybe I'm choosing not to go too deeply into his psyche, but he certainly is a guy who has something in life that he's really, really into that gives him satisfaction, that keeps him busy on a, you know, every day he makes his calls. He calls in every night after work to the sports radio station. I guess it depends how you define happiness, but, I think he thinks he's happy. He doesn't walk around. You know, he's not a guy who walks around in, I think, a depressed funk. I think he walks around thinking about his next call, and he's kind of psyched, and he has things in his life to look forward to. They happen to revolve around people, you know, that have nothing to do with him, that don't know he's alive. So you could argue that that's pathetic, that the thing that gives him satisfaction is not something that he has an actual real-life relationship with, you know, which is his team. And you know, fandom is kind of a one-way. Being an obsessive fan or a fan of any kind is kind of a one-way street. The thing you're really into doesn't know you exist, so you might choose to view that as sad. But I don't think he's sad. I think he loves it, and he's always thinking about who they're playing next week, and he's got his hopes and dreams for the team, which by extension are his own hopes and dreams. So I don't think I presented him, you know, I guess it's open to interpretation, but I didn't intend to present him as this pathetic guy that we laugh at and pity. I have a real respect for him and for anyone who has something that they care about.
Here's another clip from Big Fan.
Let's go to my boy Paul in Staten Island. He always brings the leverage. What's on your mind, brother?
Hey, Sports Talk, how you doing? I'm just calling to say I can't wait for this Sunday when we finally shut these Philly clowns up once and for all. I can't tell you how sick I am of Philadelphia Phil and all these cheesesteak bozos going on about Brian Westbrook this and how we can't stop their passing game. Are you joking? You put the tiniest bit of pressure on McNabb, that guy crumbles like a cookie. It's not easy hitting a receiver. It's not easy hitting a receiver laid out on your back. So listen up, Philadelphia Phil, and all the rest of you brotherly love jabronis who've been talking smack all week on this show. Get out your forks, because you're going to be eating your words big time.
I love his passion. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Sports Dog. You're the man.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Rob Siegel, is the director of the film Big Fan, in which Patton Oswalt plays a super-duper-duper sports enthusiast. I want to ask you about casting Patton Oswalt in the lead role. This is a guy who is certainly one of the funniest guys in America, in my opinion, a spectacular stand-up comedian.
I think he's the funniest.
Okay, well, I might say Louis C.K. I might be inclined to say Louis C.K., but it would be a tough call.
Okay. I don't agree. I've heard a lot of people feel that way. So,
Patton Oswalt's certainly a spectacularly hilarious stand-up comic, but also a guy with a very limited acting resume. He was third banana on the very successful sitcom The King of Queens for many years. He was the lead in the Pixar movie Ratatouille. And
he's done a lot of bit. You know, Reno 911.
Yeah, I was about to say, and after that, you run pretty quickly to like he was a guy in Balls of Fury, and I remember
Observe and Report.
He was an MC in that Starsky and Hutch remake, if I remember.
But he was also in Magnolia.
That's true. But I think essentially you must have picked him very specifically for this role. He wasn't just the best known person who who was willing to deign to do your film.
I could have gone with bigger names.
So what was it about Patton Oswalt as a performer that made you want him to be your lead?
I just felt he was perfect for the role. He just looks the part. He just is that part. He's totally believable. I think casting is about 90% of acting. So if you have somebody who just is utterly believable, visually, personality-wise, for a role, you're almost all the way there, right off the
now,
bat.
Now I don't know Pat. I'm not very close with Patton, but I know Patton a little bit. I'm pretty sure he's not a sports fan.
He's not, but he understands very well the psychology of nerdy obsession. He just has to take, just take whatever rant he might give about the original Avengers and transfer.
Just replace
it to,
every instance of
Giants.
Hawkeye with Phil Simms.
Exactly. I'll trust that's an accurate yes. I don't know enough about Hawkeye, but yeah, Elektra equals. Carl
something
Banks.
About Dave Meggett.
Dave Meggett, good. Look
thank
at
you.
That.
Thank you very much. I have run out of Avengers, though, off the top of my head. Hawkman? No, Hawkman's a whole other thing.
Gleek?
Okay, Gleek, sure.
No, I don't know. I know a little bit about Zan and Jaina. I don't know comics that well, but he certainly knows what it's like to be an obsessive fan, and I don't think anybody knows that psychology better than he does. And I know he can certainly go dark. There's a lot of his comedy is just incredibly hateful and misanthropic and dark. But the great thing about it, and the key thing about it for me, is that it doesn't rub off on him. You know, he still somehow, he can say the most vicious, disgusting thing, and he's still just this cuddly little huggable guy. You know, people just love Patton. He doesn't just have a likability, he has a lovability factor. He's just lovable and huggable, and he's got a great face. I knew I wanted to do a lot of close-ups and of his face, and he's just got a real interesting mug.
He's described himself often as looking kind of like a butch lesbian.
Right, I've heard that. I think it's, yeah, if you put a pair of overalls on him. He's got the look. But I wanted somebody who could kind of go dark and be a little antisocial and strange and not be off-putting and not lose the audience. You know, it was important to me that the audience somehow identified with this guy it was important that the audience liked him. And that's a hard, there are a lot of other schlubby, forgive me, Patton, short, pudgy, anti-George Clooney's out there who don't have that quality of likability that he has. People just – something about him, people just really root for him.
Do you admire the character?
Yeah, I do. I have respect and admiration for him. I didn't want this to be one of the – I was very careful. Hopefully I succeeded, but I absolutely did not want this to be one of those comedy – one of those comedies of condescension where the audience is laughing at the character. There may be moments when it comes close, but I really always wanted to be on the right side of that fence and be laughing with him and relating to him. You know, even if he's doing things that are kind of weird or sad, I just don't like those movies where you feel like the director is using his main character as kind of a punching bag, and there's sort of this icky bullying quality. There's a lot of that nowadays, particularly when it's in movies like this where superficially your character is not exactly a winner, I like this guy, and I like Randy the Ram Robinson. They may be regarded as losers by society, but I really like them and admire them because they have something that they care about.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for taking this time to be on the show. It was really great to have you.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Rob Siegel is the writer and director of the new film Big Fan. It opens August 28th in New York and Philadelphia, and then in platformed release across America by God's graces. You can find out more about screenings in other places at bigfanmovie.com. That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I have been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our theme music provided by Dan Wally, along with the rest of our music. Our editor is Nick White. Our intern is John Kim. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org. And if you have thoughts about the show, you can always email them to me. My personal email address, yes, this is my real email address, is Jesse at MaximumFun.org. J-E-S-S-E at MaximumFun.org. We'll see you next time right here on The Sound of Young America. Our interview with Rob Siegel was recorded at the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York with engineer Robert Ault.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to Vuori.com/NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Online. Is your child asking questions on their homework you don't feel equipped to answer? IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. One subscription gets you everything. One site for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And NPR listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
All that sitting and swiping, your body is adapting to your technology. Learn how and what you can do about it.
I really felt like the cloud in my brain kind of dissipated. Once I started realizing what a difference these little breaks were making, there's no turning back for me.
Take NPR's Body Electric Challenge. Listen to the series wherever you get your podcasts.